very much for those kind words. Lovely to see so many of you gathered here in my quiet place. It's only for excellent checkers to get out my long pipe. So Monica asked me, I think, if I would just sort of spend an evening with you, drawing out some of the poetry I've written and perhaps alternating with some songs, but telling a few stories and perhaps leaving a bit of time for us to have a conversation together about how the creative arts, the imaginative arts, the gift that God has given each of us, the imagination itself, and then the deeper roots of our faith, how those things can be in conversation and to help one another to flourish. So that's the plan, but it's going to be mainly songs and sonnets, I suppose. I did a CD a while back. I actually recorded it with Roy over here, who has a studio not far from here. So we did an album called Songs and Sonnets. And Songs and Sonnets was the title of a first collection by John Donne, who's an Anglican priest poet who's really important to me, as is his younger contemporary, George Herbert. It seems like every couple of 100 years, the Church of England sort of randomly produces a sort of long-haired, bearded, sonnet-writing, lute-playing priest. And I just think it's my turn. Those things are very important to me. So we'll have some songs, we'll have some sonnets, we'll have some poetry. Maybe a couple of things. First of all, the great thing about the sonnet, and this may come as a relief to some, the great thing is about the sonnet is you know when it's going to stop even before you start. You know, you can see the end on the page. And of course that's what gives it concentration. Dante Gabriel Rossetti, the great 19th century poet and painter, wrote a famous sonnet about the sonnet, which begins with the line, "A sonnet is a moment's monument." Famous line. Now, I used to think that was because a sonnet, say a love sonnet, you know, think of many of Shakespeare's sonnets, was as it were taking what might have been a fleeting moment, the moment when their eyes meet, the moment when the stars come out, the moment when the rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, whatever it might be, and that it would make in a song, in poetry, imperishably, set in verse, that fleeting moment, so that Shakespeare could say, you know, summer's lease hath all too short of days, but thy eternal summer shall not fade. I thought it was a monument to a moment, and of course it is, in one sense. But actually, once I began writing sonnets, and particularly writing sonnets with and for my church community at St. Edward's, I realised that actually, when you read a sonnet out loud, it takes almost exactly 1 minute. It is literally a moment. And that's, again, very helpful in terms of being able to, even as you hear it, retain the end and the beginning together. In fact, the book, which is probably the one that's best known for, Sound of the Seasons, which goes right through the wonderful cycle and story of the liturgical year, where these are sonnets that were first written so that they could be read within the liturgy. I can say it's a bit of a story now. I've been at the church and preaching and, you know, being part of it for some time before I began to work on these sonnets, which I did for the main Sundays, and I would be responding to the readings. We had what we called a secular reading. So the preaching was always on the biblical reading. But we'd have the biblical readings from the lecture, and then it had been my job to search, you know, literature and other places and find a little reading from outside the canon of scripture, but resonant, consonant, in conversation with that gospel reading, so that perhaps conversation might be brought out in the sermon. And there came a point where I thought, well, I can't find any more of them. You know, maybe I could just write one or two. And gradually these sonnets emerged. So often I was, if you like, taking the biblical lessons and then writing a sonnet. And I remember when it dawned on my other congregation that I was doing this thing, this big thing. And I'd previously been, I sometimes, you know, an enthusiastic and just occasionally overlong preacher. And I can remember somebody saying to me, "Malcolm, why didn't you tell us you could do it in 14 lines?" Now, there's a certain kind of truth in that. one of the reasons why I love the form of the song is precisely that it concentrates the mind, that it gives me an end, it gives me an edge. Paradoxically, I find that knowing I'm going to have 14 lines, I am entitled to a certain rhyme scheme, actually stirs my creative juices, as it were, and forces and concentrates my mind. Whereas if I had just loads of reams of paper and no form, you know, I would sort of splurge on, but it would all, you know, end up as a sort of shapeless puddle of expression. In A Winter's Tale, Shakespeare gives to a character called Autolycus a line about poetry, in which he says, "Our poetry is a current that flies each bound it chafes." So if you want fascinating, musical, fast-moving water, you know, build up the banks, put a few curves in, let the water go running down. And it's actually when the water hits the bank that it sprays out in a kind of fine overflow. But you need the banks to do that. That's what you need the structure of the poem for. So it seemed to me that the structure had been abandoned a little bit, and that it might be good to recover that. And that's one of the reasons why I chose the sonnet form. So perhaps I'll just read you a sonnet. I'll read you several sonnets. I'll read you the opening sonnet from my book, The Singing Bowl. I partly choose this poem to start off with because it happens to begin with the word begin. And it says begin the song. You know, somebody said that's a very good place to begin. So I don't know if you know about singing bowls. They actually come out of Tibet, and they're these very beautiful open empty bowls which are extremely resonant. And you don't actually even have to strike them. You can just run a beater tremblingly around, hardly touching them, and they sort of shimmer into music with wonderful high harmonics. A bit like when you run your finger around the wine glass. So let me read you this poem. I expected this to be a poem about how to write poetry. That was the plan. The plan was that the muse was going to tell me how to write poetry. You know, in epic poems in the past, poets start off by invoking the muse. And Milton says, "Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, long list of stuff, sing heavenly muse." You know, Homer and Virgil ask the muse to sing about the siege of Troy. But nowadays, you know, I think you can't, you know, an entitled middle-aged poet snaps his finger and says to his muse, "Muse, sing about this." I think she probably turns around and says, "Get lost, I'm washing my hair," you know. You can't just order your muse about. In fact, far from it, it's time to shut up and listen to your muse. So this is voice for my muse telling me something about how to write poetry. But the surprise for me was that when it was over, I realised it was also about prayer. And it was those two things coming together that were transformative for me. So here we go. Singing bowl. Begin the song exactly where you are. Remain within the world in which you're made. Call nothing common in the earth or air. Accept it all and let it be for good. Start with the very breath you breathe in now, this moment's pulse, this rhythm in your blood. And listen to it, ringing, soft and low. Stay with the music, words will come inside. Slow down your breathing, keep it deep and slow. Become an open singing line, whose chime is richness rising out of emptiness, and timelessness resounding into time. And when the heart is full of quietness, begin the song exactly. So that, as I say, was the kind of word to me about what I should do. It's not about what I do. I mean, a lot of the poems that I write turn out to be trying to bear in upon me or bring to me a wisdom that I don't possess. And it's precisely because I don't possess it that I write the poem. So I'm not saying I do this every day, but I am saying that my muse is telling me to do this. I actually have a little pot at the bottom of the garden when I go to my nursery, which I sometimes refer to as my trysting place with the muse. And, you know, I try to show up there even if she doesn't, you know, at least I keep my appointment. But I have pinned up in the corner of that hut a poem by the great American poet Wendell Berry, out of a series, he did a wonderful series of Sabbath poems, which he wrote literally on the Sabbaths, you know, in his Kentucky farm. They gathered together in a great collection now called This Is the Day. And this particular Sabbath poem is like, it's called How to Be a Poet, brackets, to remind myself, close brackets. And it's got short lines. And I have to say, I sometimes read it in my heart, and I don't get past line 3, because like I've already not managed that. So let me see if I can remember a bit for you. It sounds like this. Make a place to sit down. Sit down. Be quiet. That's line 3. You must depend upon wisdom, clarity, patience, time. More of these than you have. It's depending upon what you have. For patience, Joyce joins time to eternity. It's full of great lines. It's got a wonderful line. There are no unsacred places, only sacred places and desperate places. Astonishingly sacred. The end of the poem is this. Accept what comes from the silence. Make the best you can of it. Try to make a poem which does not obscure the silence from which it comes. Extraordinary. Extraordinary writing. When you think of so much discourse, so much language, so much generated texts and tweets and everything, flashing around the place, doing nothing, obscuring a silence which might be the silence of reflection, or the silence of prayer, or the silence of patience and charity before something was uttered. Some people describe poetry as language slowed down, and that's perhaps quite a helpful thing, you know, sort of hyper accelerated age. Obviously, if you are a poet, you love language and you love words, and you both care for words and want them to live and flourish, and you deeply regret and lament those times when great words are either neglected or even abused. Let me just read you one or two before we look at some of the poems and the songs you're about. Directly, but I think, just read you one or two poems about the nature of language. So, we had I did a thing at the Steamworks Brewery last night for a thing called Theology on Tap. But it wasn't just, in fact, one of the people who came brought his very young son, because his very young son writes poetry and wanted to be a poet, was, along with my amazing, a fan of mine, so possibly my youngest fan. And so he said to me, so how do you be a poet? Like, how do you do that? How do you write poetry? How long have you got? But I thought I'd start with something really practical. Maybe actually I think I might be just as happy if you don't mind sort of walking about a bit and then I can turn and see more of you. So I said to him, well, what happens with me? Do you remember how Dishra said in the singing bowl? Stay with the music, words will come in time. I feel for a sound, sometimes almost a melody or a rhythm. And then if I'm lucky, a few words and phrases come to me. I'm not sure where they're going to go or what they're going to be about, but I like them. So I'll write them down on a piece of paper. And then I said to this young boy, I said, look, if nobody's looking, I'll take the few words that I've got
and I'll lift them up and I'll say,
have you got any friends? Literally, because they came kind of uninvited, but I want to be hospitable to the sound. And they almost always have. One word seems to summon another. Certain words seem to want to go together. Some words are in opposition, but they like being in opposition. I have to think about that. And I suddenly realise that actually the words are going to come and they're going to bless me. And then I realise something much more important. You know, what possible basis can one person with their tiny perspective writing around themselves, even if they're writing musically in sonic form, hope to offer from the little sort of small personal vessel of whatever wisdom they happen to record in their brief life, offer anything more widely? Not a lot of it. But I write with the conviction that all the words I use, the words themselves, are older and wiser than I am. They've been around. They carry stories. Some of the deep, rich words, the most important words, the words graced and blessed in the gospel, are overflowing. They have, to use a lovely Greek word, pleroma. They have a kind of rich, generative, generous abundance. If only we'll let them be themselves and not rush them back by so fast that music no sooner arrived than we dismiss them. So I say as a word, you've got me friends. And then some of the words show up. Now, there's a very famous passage in T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets where he talks about his relationship with words. And I have to say, much as I love T.S. Eliot, in this particular passage, he comes to me as a little bit sort of bossy and dictatorial with his words. He says, he's complaining about the bad behaviour of words and sentences, and says, words slip, slide, decay with imprecision, will not stay still, you know, will not stay in place. And then he says that he's making raids on the inarticulate with shabby equipment, always deteriorating the general mess and imprecision of feeling. Like, if you have to be a word in a T.S. Eliot poem, you know, maybe stand for attention and then be like a sergeant major, you know, and I just feel, you know, and then you're driven off into the inarticulate. I don't fancy it myself. And obviously, I don't feel like I could be some sort of crack officer driving his words forward. So how do I feel as a poet about words? I feel not like a sergeant major, but I feel, and maybe this is just the way I spend my life, but I feel more like a sort of genial host, you know, who's holding a good dinner party for some old friends and some new, and is looking forward to a great evening's conversation. And insofar as I have any skill in the matter, it's to do with, as it were, the skill that a host has in arranging the table places and thinking, ooh, do you know, these two words that are coming tonight, they haven't sat next to each other since they met at the end of a John Donne sonnet. I expect we've got a bit of catching up to do. And in a sense, it's the tensions and conferences and conversations between the words that I overhear. So I tried to put that in a poem, and it's called Hospitality. I turn a certain key within its wards, unlock my doors, and set them open wide to entertain a company of words. While some come early and with eager stride, others must be enticed and coaxed a little, the shy and rare, unused to company, who need some time to feel at home and settle. I bid them welcome all. I make them free of all that's mine, and they're good to me. I set them in the order they like best, and listen for their wisdom. Try to learn as each unfolds the other's mystery. And though we know each word is my free guest, they sometimes even poem in return. And so that's one way of thinking about it. So if you love words as well, you also care immensely for their flourishing and their preservation. Somebody invented the term, it's actually
I think it's an important word, although it's a slightly angry word. They invented the term verbicide. So verbicide is killing words, destroying them, removing them. And of course, we all know, you know, George Orwell explored that idea in 1984, that if you took away vocabulary, you would take away the possibility of thinking certain things. And that he imagined a totalitarian regime doing that by sheer fear. But actually, the verbicide, if you like, the elimination of words, the narrowing of vocabulary, the narrowing of the range of possibility, is happening by a series of other insidious pressures in our society. Some years ago, a friend of mine, a colleague at Cambridge, and a very great writer, Robert McFarlane, wrote an article in the Guardian newspaper in which he noticed there'd been a fresh edition of the Oxford Junior Dictionary. And the Oxford Junior Dictionary is obviously from the same house as the British Oxford English Dictionary, but it's intended for sort of 8 to 14 year olds, and it's often used in school, and it's accessible, but it's scholarly, and so on. Now, obviously, every time it's often they have new editions of the Oxford Junior Dictionary, and they have to update it because new language is being created and new words come into use, and so on. And obviously, because it's a finite book, it's an actual book, a pair of books, two volumes, they have to miss out some words in order to include others. And amazingly, they call that culling. They cull certain words. And Robert McFarlane, who teaches English at Cambridge, was thumbing through the new edition of the Oxford English, Oxford Junior Dictionary, and he noticed that certain words were missing. He began to do a systematic search and realised there was an extraordinary sense of what was being culled there. He wrote an article about it, which caused great controversy. Oxford wrote back and said, look, we're not trying to eliminate things, it's just that we have an algorithm. You know, it's going to be bad news after that. So they have an algorithm which searches all the kind of stuff that the target audience, the 8 to 14 year olds, are likely to be reading in the brain, and then it checks the frequencies and things, and it eliminates words from the dictionary that are less likely to be encountered. That's actually not at all what they should do, because we really never would do any of the dictionaries. But anyway. So I was reading this article some years ago, and Rob McFarlane listed in alphabetical order the words which were no longer deemed necessary or no longer represented in the great authoritative dictionary, you know, that these kids would be there. And let me recollect them. As I read them, they felt like a prose poem. These are the words that would come. Acorn. Adam. Ash. Buttercup. Bluebell. Catkin. Cowslip. Signet, otter, newt, pasture, willow, strawberry. And you know what? They were removed to make room for celebrity, chat room, upload. Now, it's deeply ironic, of course, because every 8 to 14 year old really knows what celebrity, chat room, and upload are. They might have to explain it to me. But these words are gone. So Rob wrote this little article. And when I read it, I wrote a poem immediately, sometimes you wait, but literally that evening, I went to my desk and I wrote a poem about Drudgy, which I just used. Subsequently, Rob himself then began to think, all right, I sent him the poem. And he then wrote a beautiful children's book called The Lost Words, in which he writes a magical spell with an acrostic that has the word and invites the children of England to summon these words back. And they're beautifully illustrated now. It's become perfect. Anyway, let me read you this. This is a lament for lost words on learning that certain words have been culled from the Oxford Junior Dictionary. To graceful names and lovely woods, farewell. To acorn, adder, ash, to beech and bluebell, farewell, old friend. I name you in my sonnet, buttercup, catkin, conker, cowslip, cigarette. Farewell. Your fields are brick, our books are barren, no dandelion or fern,
hazel or heron. We'll go no more alone, no more together. The mantle time is gone, and gone the heather. The clinging ivy's gone, and soon to go the kingfisher's blue bogs, the mistletoe, nectar, newt and otter, pasture, willow. To their last rites my muse comes, footing slow. We'll hear no more the heaven-scaling lark. We'll all go down together in the dark. So let me now lift you up with one last thing about words before we have a song, and
then think about how words might begin to approach the deeper mysteries of my faith.
I'll lift you up by reading you a poem
about how we can generate language, how new things can happen. So this poem is called Spell. I'm fascinated by the fact, and this actually I think may also have been part of Rob then deciding to create these wonderful spells, which you literally spell out the word and then it's back for you. But I was fascinated by the fact, this curious thing, that spell, as in spelling and spelling tests, and the thing that I was really bad at school, I discovered after I got my very first job as a grown-up, my first job teaching English in the high school. And I'd been there a month or two, and I was talking to the headmaster who made the appointment, and he said, do you know what, one of the reasons why your application came to the top is that it was full of spelling mistakes. I was so intrigued that a person with a good degree from Cambridge, and obviously a passionate interest in literature, could actually send an application to teach English with so many uncorrected mistakes. I thought, I want to meet this guy. So it's really weird. Anyway, the fact that spelling was never my strong point, and that was the days before spell checkers, you know. And I really wish I'd lived in Shakespeare's day. I mean, famously, he spells his own name three different ways in his will. And orthography, as it's called, spelling, wasn't actually formalised until the 18th century, and even then, even into the 19th century, the variations. And it meant when, before that, if you by spelling a word in a slightly different way, you could make puns and word plays, and you could, you know. I mean, for example, in sun, as in the sun in the sky, and son, my son, could both be spelled S-O-N-N-E in the 17th century, and is the old fool runner of son. Anyway, I was never very good at it. But I'm very interested that spell, that hard thing to do in English lessons, is also spell. That magical thing that summons new beauty into the world of spell. And the same is true of chant. Enchantment has the word chant in it. And it seems to me that in fact that's entirely right, because there is something magical. Indeed, it's more than magical. Magical is a very minor way of talking about it. It's not surprising that for us, language and word should have this extraordinary power of summoning new images and making for new possibilities in the minds of a reader or a hearer. Because deep in the very core of the being of things is this truth that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and that the Genesis narrative in the Old Testament tells us of a God who says, let there be light, and there is light, who, as it were, utters the world into being. And our own possibility of uttering anything must be a very faint, far-off echo, his image in us, of that great speaking of what the poet Coleridge said. The poet Coleridge, looking around at the hills and the mountains and the beautiful things he could see, and imagining his little boy growing up amongst those scenes, he said of his child, he says, thou, my child, shall wander like a breeze by lakes and sandy shores beneath the crags of ancient mountains, so shalt thou see and hear the lovely shapes and sounds intelligible of that eternal language which thy God utters, who doth teach himself in all and all things in himself, great universal teacher, he shall mould thy spirit and by giving make it ask. And the great passages of English poetry confess at midnight. Notice the tense.
that eternal language which thy God utters. It's not finished yet. He's speaking us all into being. So it's not surprising, therefore, that for us, language has this summoning power. So I wrote this poem, which is just called Spout, and I'll use this to lift us up from the lost words and things that are capable of generating new ones. So this is just called Spout. Summon the summoners, the 26 enchanters, spelling silence into sound. They bind and loose, they find and are not found. Recall the river tongues from Alf to Styx. Summon the summoners, the shaping shapes, the grounds of sound, the generative grammar, signs of the mystery, inscribed arcana, runes from the root tree written in the deeps, leaves from the tail tree lifted, swift and free, shining, recombining in air dance the genesis of every utterance, pattering the pattern of the tree. Summon the summoners and let them sing. The summoners will summon everything. So, a celebration of the 26 letters of the alphabet. And take comfort from this, I take comfort from this. When you sit down as a writer, and perhaps some of you are writers in different ways, and you think, I've got these 26 letters to play with, you have got, in all its fullness, the exact same toolkit of Shakespeare. Come on, you know, you must be in with a chance. You know, you're bound to strike it lucky, you know, keep recombining those letters. You'll get some. And the possibilities are limitless. So, going back to the poem I started with, which was, going back to the poem I started with, Begin the Song Exactly Where You Are, often poetry is referred to as song. Milton says, A, my adventurous song that with no middle flight intends to soar, although he wasn't actually singing Paradise Lost. Though, do you know, you guys know Paradise Lost, sir? Advance versus disobedience, and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe, with loss of Eden, till one great man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Sing, that's a good verb, come on, sing, heavenly muse, but on the secret top of Oregon. So he doesn't sing it. Though, just you can try this for later. Somebody pointed out to me once that you can, in fact, sing the opening line of Paradise Lost to the tune of the Flintstones. Milton didn't do that. But so song is sometimes referred to just as poetry. But the reason why poetry is sometimes called song is that poetry originally was song. And the earliest poetry, if we look at the great epics, if we look at Homer, or if we, in English we look at Beowulf, there's almost always a scene where there's a big feast. And then they call out the bard. And the bard has a lyre or some other stringed instrument. That's where we get the word lyric from. Lyric poetry, too. And throngs away in the Anglo-Saxon days, it was known as a show, and makes it throngs away and sings. And so that's, you know, that's where it started. And it translated itself over onto the page. My view is that if you're going to have a poem on the page unaccompanied by music, then it must carry its music with it. That's why I say stay with the music. The French poet Verlaine just has a sonnet about poetry which begins, De la musique avant tout chose. And one of the things I think is tragic about contemporary poetry and post-Soviet poetry is that a lot of it's lost its music. It feels like chopped prose to me. It's been called poetry just because the lines don't reach the end of the page. But, you know, you can't hear a kind of rhythm and a sound. So I think poems have to carry their own music. Songs, of course, where they've got a musical background, so I'm going to play some songs as well. I write songs as well as poems. But when I write a song, I write it with the guitar in my hand. And I try and hear
So it's great to see you all, and I have to say, although this has been a quite full and kind of exhausting tour in America, which this is another last night, I have been wonderfully entertained with great hospitality by many people over dinner. I just had the hospitality of Roy in his studio there, but many other people as well. And I love one of my favourite verses in scripture. It's from Hebrews 13, where it says, "Practice hospitality, for by so doing some have entertained angels unawares." I love that. Of course, it's an allusion, isn't it, to the story in Genesis of Abraham and Sarah at the oaks of Mamre. You know, when they're exhausted, the whole God's promise you're going to have kids doesn't seem to be working out at all. They're past it. They're running, you know, just in the middle of nowhere, and they've got hardly anything left to do. Then, wouldn't you know, three strangers turn up? But they would dig deep and reach deep, and they're hospitable. And of course, that's the point of renewal. And the strangers, who are God himself, coming in three persons in one, says Sarah's going to conceive. And Sarah, which is at the back of the tent, fixing the food, that's, she laughs, because she says, "Look, you know, believe me, I'm positive." She laughs. Now, of course, she has a child, and naturally, when that child is born, they call him laughter. That's what Isaac means, and the whole promise moves forward. But so practice hospitality by so doing, some have entertained angels unawares. I like the Abraham story, and I love the phrase "angels unawares." Just something about it. I thought they had all kinds of positive possibilities. So I wrote the song, which is called "Angels Unawares," which kind of explores some of those possibilities. But I'll play it there. Not only for you who are hosting me here at Trinity Western, but in a sense again, it's sort of for all the other people who have practiced hospitality. Some people say that life is just a given thing, but you and I both know. Right here and there, where we've all been loved and hurt, the love himself has come to pitch his tent. Sometimes we're in the fields of holy roses, other times we're rolling in the tent. But drinking bread, sharing wine, did I feel your hand touch mine, or did we both touch angels unaware? Abraham is down by the oaks of Mamre. Joseph dreams beside an empty barn. There's a woman and a man, the dreams no man can tell. Though a broken man might keep her safe from home, there's somebody else inside my fiery furnace. Jacob gazes up those endless stairs. We are all wounded on this road, but we share each other's load. We make each other angels unaware. Everybody backs into the future. Everyone is just feeling for it blind. Sometimes we get lost, all the threads of our lives get crossed, but I'm sure that yours got tangled up with mine. Day is gone and I know I should be going. Yeah. boy's studio. So he lent me a guitar. And I said to him, this is a really nice guitar. And he said, yeah, it was actually made for Bono and U2. But it's got like one on it and U2 backwards. Made by this very famous maker, Duncan, who actually, this thing was going to Africa and trying to help with, in Ugandan villages, getting really good craftsmen to work on the guitars and then U2. And then for various reasons, for whatever, you know, U2 didn't acquire it or keep it. So somehow Roy managed to get hold of it because it would be in his studio. So he's finally let me bring it out, you know, and obviously I'm not worthy of the guitar, but so I can only proper guitar player, Steve Bell, is coming in to Vancouver and playing, I believe, on Sunday night. So, you know, he'll be there for some time. So, just like I said in the singing bowl, you know, sometimes the poem or the song is addressed to you rather than being something you've acquired. You know, the poet Yeats, in the preface to one of his collected poems, he said, look, when a poet's writing a poem, which they thought a lot about, they put a real order into it, and they use the first person, so like the poet is speaking. It might be quite resonant, it might be musical, it might even be wise. But, Yeats said, the poet, capital P in the book, the poet is not the bundle of incoherence that sits down to breakfast. And that's very true. I mean, I was a bundle of incoherence sitting down to breakfast this morning. Trying to make sure I didn't do second breakfast as well. But in other words, I go to language and I go to the order of it and I go to reflection, not in order to say what I already know or practice, but to let a longer, wiser, deeper tradition form something that will teach me. And I take the view that if a poem doesn't push back and tell you something you didn't know before you started the poem, it's probably not a poem. It's probably just a memo. The same goes with songs. This song is called Lente, Lente. Lente means slowly, gently, deliberately. You know? I have a friend who makes his gardener, professional gardener in one of the colleges in Cambridge. But in the winter, when there's a little bit less to do on the gardening front, she makes felt. She kind of gets all the layers and, you know, makes beautiful felt things. And her little felt company is called Lente. And she sees me zapping around at high speed. It's like, Lente, Lente, gently. So I feel like I put that into a song. Too fast.
shelter. My heart lies open like the Book of Kells. I'll draw sweet water from deep lands when I learn to draw it gently. Slow down, flower, count to 20. Learn to gaze on life intently. You know it's wonderful, and you know you're in the presence of great mystical theology, but if you're like me, you can't see it at all. It's kind of going around in this beautiful, ethereal, you know, extra-temporal, eternal state of generative beingness, but, you know, like, for the rest of us down here. And then, suddenly, you get to verse 14. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, glories of the only begotten of the Father, of grace and truth.
Everything that I might have apprehended or wished or hoped for or glimpsed about heaven, but not been sure of, God utterly assures me of. He bodies it forth in the person of Jesus Christ and his word. And his word is love. What is love? This is living God, living love. That love is not left as some kind of abstract theory, but is bodied forth in flesh, so that I might meet him and he might meet me, and we might know one another, and I might experience that love. So it's bodied forth. And in a curious way, I think every other kind of bodying forth, every artistic bodying forth, depends on the fact that God has done it first and made the possibility of such a bodying forth and actually made us in the image of the one who bodies forth. Of course, J.R.R. Tolkien summed all this brilliantly in just one line of one poem in his Metopeia. He says, "We make still by the Lord by which we're made." I want to just read to you now some of the poems in which I've tried, as it were, to let the mystery and beauty of the words that show up at my heart and listen to their conversation and try, as it were, to body forth and make a verse for some of the ways in which I apprehend the mystery of who God is and of the faith that comes to me. And a lot of them were in a book called Sounding the Seasons. And it does sort of go through the church year. So I'm going to read you just a few from Sounding the Seasons. We'll be sort of dipping in. It's 70 sonnets. In one way, you can read any one of these poems as an individual sonnet, and lots of people do and use them, you know, in church service and things like that. But I also hope sometimes, occasionally, somebody might sit down, if they've got a spare evening, you know, with this book, and read it right through. Because another way of understanding this book is to think of it as a 70 stanza poem, telling the story of what God has done for us and how he draws us into that story and we become part of that story ourselves. And there are various little threads of connection that I've written into poems that make it clear that they're kind of trying to unwind. Great. So I'm going to read you the prologue, which opens it out, a few from inside it, and then the last one, which you'll see sort of the little centers, which kind of gathers it. And I'll do that without further comment, so we'll just, you know, so you can, I hope you enjoy this bit. Sounding the Seasons, prologue. Tangled in time, we go by hints and guesses, turning the wheel of each returning year. But in the midst of failures and successes, we sometimes glimpse the love that casts out fear. Sometimes the heart remembers its own reasons and beats a sanctus as we sing our story, tracing the threads of grace, sounding the seasons that lead at last through time to timeless glory. From the first yearning for a Saviour's birth to the full joy of knowing sins forgiven, we start our journey here on God's good earth to catch an echo of the choirs of heaven. I send these out, returning what was lent, turning to praise each moment's monument. So I'm going to read you one of the Advent ones now, which is that yearning for God. I'll read you the final Advent one, which is called Advent one. O come, and be our God with us. O long sought witness for a world without. O secret seed, O hidden spring of light, come to us, wisdom. Come, unspoken name, come, root and key and king and holy flame. O quickened little wick, so tightly curled, be folded with us into time and place. Unfold for us the mystery of grace and make a womb of all this wounded world. O heart of heaven, beating the earth, O tiny hope within our hopelessness, come to be born, to bear us to our birth, to touch a dying world with new-made hands, and make these
rags of time. Our swaddling bands. And I said, I thought it was just lovely when the baby was here. Like, I'll have that at every gig. was perfect for that. So that was O Emmanuel. It's about longing for Christmas to come. Here's a poem for Christmas itself. It's called On the Edge. Christmas sets the centre on the edge. The edge of town, outbuildings of an inn, the fringe of empire, far from privilege and power. On the edge, an outer spin of turning worlds, a margin of small stars. The edge, a galaxy, itself light years from some unguessed at cosmic origin. Christmas sets the centre at the edge, and from this day, our world is realigned. A tiny seed unfolding in the womb becomes the source from which we all unfold and flower into being. We are healed. The end begins. The tomb becomes a womb. For now in him all things are realigned. Going on through the sweep of the year, during the season of Epiphany, we celebrate not only the Feast of Epiphany itself and the wise men and the Magi coming, but actually, interestingly, all the other epiphanies, all the moments of shining out and shining forth, when Jesus kind of reveals, remember, who he is, and people get a bit of it. So I'm going to read you the Magi poem, that is the actual Epiphany, and then I'm going to read you one of my favourite epiphanies, frankly, which is which we have in the Epiphany seasons of reading, which is the miracle of Cana, which is my personal favourite miracle. So here's one about Magi, who you remember, of course. That's the point in Matthew's Gospel, which is all about Jewish lineage and heritage. When the Gentiles show up, so this is where we can. Have you had that experience of somebody's invited you to a party, and it's like a big family party, and their family's doing all their catch-up, you know. And like, you don't know anybody. You hang on, it's all this stuff. And then he said, Jane. And then suddenly in the middle of the conversation, you hear your name. You go, ding, you know. Oh, do I belong to any part of the story? I always feel the arrival of the three wise men is like that for us in the Bible. It's like, this is a whole event. Oh, wait a minute, we come in. So here's a measure. It might have been just someone else's story. Some chosen people get a special king. We leave them to their own peculiar glory. We don't belong. It doesn't mean a thing. But when these three arrive, they bring us with them. Gentiles like us, their wisdom might be ours. A steady step that finds an inner rhythm. A pilgrim's eye that sees beyond the stars. They did not know his name, but still they sought him. They came from otherwhere, but still they found. In palaces, found those who sold and bought him. But in the filthy stable, hallowed ground. Their courage gives our questing hearts a voice to seek, to find, to worship, to rejoice. And then the last of the Epiphany by Montier, which is the miracle of Cana. The first miracle, according to John, this was the first of the signs that he did and manifested his glory. I remember when I first worked, I made the old translations when I was a kid. So it said there were six stone jars holding two or three firkins apiece. And you're going, firkins? I don't even know what that is. So, when you're told that it all goes up to 180 gallons, you go, okay, now that's not bad for a brain of occupancy. You know, God's overabundant generosity. So here we are, the miracle came. Here's an epiphany to have and hold, a truth that you can taste upon the tongue. No distant shrines or
canopies of gold or ladders to be clambered rung by rung. But here and now, amidst your daily living, where you can taste and touch and feel and see the spring of love, the fount of all forgiving flows when you need it, rich, abundant, free, better than waters of some outer weeping that leave you still with all your hidden sin. Here is a vintage, richer for the keeping, that works its transformation from within. What price, you ask me, as we raise the glass? It cost our Saviour everything he has.
So, going on through the year, I'm going to just take us now into the kind of, you notice how time slows down in the Gospels when you approach Holy Week. There's great drama about salvation, the kind of climax of the whole thing, death and resurrection. Suddenly, you know, it's taking pages just to get to do a day. Everything's significant. So I sort of slowed the sonnets down too, and from Holy Week, from Palm Sunday onwards, I did a sonnet for each day, and then on the day, Good Friday, I followed the traditional station of the cross and did 14. But don't worry, I'm not reading. So I'm going to read you the Palm Sunday poem, because that sets out what I'm trying to do in the others. My understanding of this divine narrative is that it is both historical and eternal. But it is both out there and back then, but also in here and right now. That in some sense, we're all invited to open the gates of Jerusalem. We're all invited to have him cleanse the temple in here as well. I mean, I love that thing in the Psalms about blessed is the man in whose heart of the highest design. Actually, I think that's true of all of us in a sense. We bear the remnants of paradise. We have here a temple that he should come to. There's also a seat of judgment, you know, where we sometimes allow the pilots of our mind, the representatives of pagan power, to make decisions for us instead of, you know, listening to our king. So this is the kind of invitation poem, Palm Sunday. So Jesus is arriving in Jerusalem. Now, to the gate of my Jerusalem, the seething holy city of my heart, the Saviour comes. But will I welcome him? Oh, crowds of easy feelings make a start. They raise their hands, get caught up in the singing, and think the battle won. Too soon, they'll find the challenge, the reversal he is bringing, changes their tune. I know what lies behind the surface flourish that so quickly fades. Self-interest and fearful guardedness, the hardness of the heart, its barricades, and at the core, the dreadful emptiness of a perverted temple. Jesus, come, break my resistance, and make me your home. And then there comes, and if you think about the big events of Holy Week, like the cleansing of the temple and, you know, the teaching of the temple and then the going to the judgment seekers, there's a whole load of huge, big public things happening. And then in the narrative, you get this one beautiful, intimate, quiet episode where you sort of see these darkenings in the house of Bethany when Mary and Martha and Lazarus are there and when she anoints his feet. And so this is my take on the anointing. Come close with Mary, Martha, Lazarus. So close, the candles flare with their soft breath and kindle heart and soul to flame within us, lit by these mysteries of life and death. For beauty now begins the final movement in quietness and intimate encounter. The alabaster jar of precious ointment is broken open for the world's true lover. The whole room richly fills to feast the senses with all the yearning such a fragrance brings. The heart is mourning, but the spirit dances here at the very centre of all things. Here
So, again, in this sort of arc of the story, I then spent 14 sonnets thinking about, and as it were, trying to walk with Jesus through the story of the crucifixion, understanding that at just the point where we think, if we follow the stations of the cross, we're walking with him on his Via Dolorosa. But actually, the reverse is happening. The more we do that, the more he's actually walking into us. And so I think I'll just... I picked up the idea of the meeting of love and loss with Mary at Bethany, lamenting because she could see what was coming, and talked about how love and loss meet again, but in a transformative way on the cross. So I'm going to read you just the sonnet of all the stations. There's station 11, is the crucifixion itself. Jesus is nailed to the cross. I'll read you that. And then, so it's not to leave you there. I'll read the resurrection poem as well. I was when I was at the vicar first, I went to church school and junior school. Yeah. And my predecessor had been a really strict ritualist, right? These liturgical ideas that you only ever mention a certain thing in the season and you never mention it out of season, right? It's like, you must never do that, you absolutely keep it. And unfortunately, that's not good for school terms in a church school. So it was always term time in Holy Week and leading up to Good Friday. But it was always the holidays in Easter. So he wouldn't talk about the resurrection. So all these generations of kids were learning about how Jesus was nailed to the cross. But they never got the end of the story. And I went to see the headmaster when I arrived. I knew priests, they were so talking about this and that. And the headmaster was saying, you could see he was going to ask a really big, embarrassing question. I was ready for me to say, and he said, no. I was just wondering if maybe before we leave, maybe I'll ask Ed Turner or something. He said, would you think we could? Hallelujah! Yes, of course you can. So I'm going to be, oh, I know it's not Easter, but I will mention. Okay, I'll read you the crucifixion poem, which is and I'll read the resurrection poem. So 11. Jesus is nailed to the cross. See, as they strip the robe from off his back, and spread his arms and nail them to the cross. The dark nails pierce him and the sky turns black and love is firmly fastened onto loss. But here a pure change happens. On this train, loss becomes gain. Death opens into birth. Here, wounding heals and fastening makes free. Earth breathes in heaven. Heaven roots in earth. And here we see the length, the breadth, the height, where love and hatred meet and love stays true. Where sin meets grace and darkness turns to light, we see what love can bear and be and do. And here, our Saviour calls us to his side. His love is free. His arms are open wide. And then, preparing for Easter dawn, staying in John 20, in that wonderful thing with Mary Magdalene, coming early, and then the others coming. She stays. She went. I don't know if you've noticed in that passage, Peter and John, they're looking, they're racing each other, guy thing, who's going to get there first, and this, and then it's all look, what's it, and then they're like headless chickens, they're just completely discombobulated. And meantime, there's this simple, steady, strong woman standing there. Who knows, this is the last place she saw Jesus and she's not going to leave it. So, Easter dawn. He blesses every love that weeps and grieves.
now he blesses hers, who stood and wept and would not be consoled or leave her love's last touching place, but watched as low light crept up from the east. A sound behind her stirs a scatter of bright birdsong through the air. She turns, but cannot focus through her tears or recognize the gardener standing there. She hardly hears his gentle question, "Why? Why are you weeping?" Or sees the play of light that brightens as she chokes out her reply, "They took my love away. My day is night." And then she hears her name. She hears love say the word that turns her night and ours to day.
So that takes us to the joy of the resurrection. Of course, the church year carries on wonderfully, and we think about Trinity, and we think about the coming of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, so we continue the story. So I'll read you Pentecost, and then I'm just going to read the last poem, and I'll see. So you've got to look at this. Okay. So here's the Pentecost poem. Today, we feel the wind beneath our wings. Today, the hidden fountain flows and plays. Today, the church draws breath at last and sings as every flame becomes a tongue of praise. This is the feast of fire, air and water, poured out and breathed and kindled into earth. The earth herself awakens to her maker, translated out of death and into birth. The right words come today in their right order, and every word spells freedom and release. Today, the gospel crosses every border. All tongues are loosened by the Prince of Peace. Today, the lost are found in his translation, whose mother tongue is love in every nation. So let's go to the very last one, which bridges back to the first. And this is just called Epilogue Sanctus. I wrote this after listening to, I was at a great Christian arts festival in England called Greenbelt, and they decided that weekend to do a scratch Mozart's Requiem. So literally everybody showed up with instruments and, you know, so, and they just, the whole crowd between them put together Mozart's Requiem. And it was wonderful hearing this great Sanctus, the three great Sanctuses that you hear in that, and that's partly what inspired this. We gather as his church on God's good earth and listen to the Requiem's intense, long, love-laden keening, calling forth echoes of Eden, blessing every sense with brilliant blisses, every death with birth, until all passion passes into praise. I bless the hidden threads that drew us here. I bless this day distinct amidst our days. I bless the light, the music-laden air. I bless the interweaving of our ways, the lifting of the burdens that we bear. I bless the broken body that we share. Sanctus, the heart. Sanctus, the spirit cries. Sanctus, the flesh. In every touch, replies. I'm going to. There's a couple of songs and poems, and then you spread them up. This is still a tune. And I have another classic. What did I do with my guitar pick? No. I discovered by having a band that. If you play in bands and bars and bands, whenever I go to the bar to buy a drink, I have a handful of guitar picks. And whenever I go to get a guitar pick, I've got coins, you know, it's just strange.
tuning?
It's close enough for what I do, I think. Anyway, so songs can start in all kinds of different ways. And sometimes you just sort of, as with poems, you kind of overhear a phrase, you know, and you think, really? And you just carry it around with you in a sense. And I went into a pub, or what had been a decent English pub, the last time I visited it. But unfortunately, it had one of these awful makeovers, you know, some corporate thing had bought it, you know, and they turned it into a sort of swish kind of wine bar. And it was all, you know, polished marble tops and, you know, was, you know, sort of, you know, Nordic minimalism and and there were a couple of, you know, guys in suits having an earnest conversation about money and wealth when I went to, you know, some of the good old boys having a beer and singing a few songs. It was just a complete transformation. So I realised I was in the wrong place. But even as I was hastily beating a retreat, I heard one of these smart men in suits leaning forward to the other and saying, without a hint of irony, saying, you know, life is a game and money is how you keep score. Anyway, so it was all about kind of that position. As it happened, I'd been rereading C.S. Lewis's glorious, glorious sermon, The Way to Glory, and you know, one of the seminal texts, I think. So near the beginning of that, he's talking about how the deepest yearning for us is to God. You know, we don't just want. And he says the trouble with us is not that we desire too much, but that we desire too little. We're too easily satisfied. We're sort of, you know, hanging around in the shadows of sex and money while we could be out in the source of the cosmos, you know. And he says we're like kids, you know, playing with mud pies in the gutter because we just haven't yet got the imagination to conceive what a seaside holiday would really be like. So that was kind of in my mind. And then these two guys getting money as well, you know. So this song came out and it's called. Try for some. Well, don't mind the bargain, but we want to own the whole store. We say life is a game, we say money is how we keep score. So you sell your time for the highest bids. Everyone's a winner, except for your kids. You think I want less, believe me, I want more. I want the swimming pool, I want the source of the river. You want the lifestyle, I want to meet the life giver. Alright then, you take the many, I'll take the one. You can add to your collection, it'll never get done. You can cry for the moon, I'm going to try for the sun. You got notches on your peak, you got numbers on your gatepost, golden letters over your door. Notches on your bedpost, you can't remember who they're for. Well, you remember a girl with glimmering eyes. You can't remember which of you was wearing the disguise. Think I want less, believe me, I want more. You want the surface, I want the depth behind it. You want to flirt with the truth, I want to get out there and find it. I'll take the one you can add to your collection till you're comfortably numb. You can cry at the moon. I'm gonna try for some. You want your numbers to come up in that lottery draw. You want to pretend that you'll never be helpless again. You want promotion, status, and power. You want the rest of us to grovel. I think I want less, believe me, I want more. You want the song, I want the one who played it. You want the world, I want the one who made it. Alright then, you take the many, I'll take the one. You can't take your collection into kingdom come, you can cry at the moon.
cry for the moon. I'm going to try for the sun. A song which actually got me into trouble. And of course, there was an intervention on some of my more hard work. But in fact, I think it was misunderstood. So, I wrote the song, it's called Green, and it's a bit of a sort of signature song for me. And it arose very straightforwardly. I was walking with a friend of mine from Cambridge to Manchester. I play in the pub in Manchester. I was walking along with beautiful, beautiful hedgerows along the meadows of Manchester. Which is a fabulous place, and almost all the poets in Cambridge have ever been there. You know, I walked along that thing, and Milton wrote about it, and Wordsworth wrote about it. You know, and Pink Floyd didn't know more about it. So, yeah. So anyway, we're walking along, and I was reflecting on William Blake's fantasy that maybe one day, maybe Jesus would come to England, and did those feats in ancient times, walk up on England's mountains green, almost the Holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures sing. Did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? Was Jerusalem builded here among those dark satanic mills? Well, historically, probably not. But, it is another sentiment we have to paint. So we were just talking about this. And we started to riff on the idea that the great I am sayings in John's Gospel, I am the vine and you are the branches and I am the door of the sheep and me. What would that have been like if Jesus had actually been walking, with his disciples through Grantchester Meadows and among the curtains and the little chandeliers and the beautiful old carved choirs of the cathedrals and stuff? So, just out of nowhere, I just sort of said, well, maybe he'd say, I am the green man. Like he says, greater than Solomon, you see. But in a sense, that face in the foliage, it always come up in churches. All the green men we've got are actually in churches, on the outside. And would come up by people who were making these great living forests of stone that lived up. And I don't know, I just have a sense, that Lewis very strongly says that the pagan religions, the kind of first feelings after, in Romans, God has not left himself without this, are kind of gestures towards the fullness of what God will do. Of course, Christ is greater than all of these, but he's not lesser. There's a song by a Scottish Irish band called The Waterboy, which has the lines, at sea in a ship in a thunderstorm, on the very night that Christ was born, the sailors heard from overhead a mighty voice cry, Pan's dead. So follow Christ as best you can. Pan's dead. Long live Pan. What dies is left behind. The goodness and bestness is the word of all of that is given back. And you get that in C.S. Lewis all the time. So, for example, when he's liberating, when they're liberating the town of Beruna in Prince Caspian, Aslan summons Bacchus. And his wonderful vines break the bridge, And they have a marvelous song, And I love the bit when, after they've gone going around with Bacchus and the Minas, and they fall into a glorious heap, Silas crying out for more. And Lucy says, that was a wonderful adventure, but I shouldn't have felt quite safe with Bacchus and his fierce Minas if Aslan hadn't been here. And Susan says, I should think not. But strangely, that episode was completely missed out from the film. So I was experimenting with these things. I thought, I'll write the I Am the Green Man song, right? So, I wrote this I Am the Green Man song, and And interestingly, the guys in the pub, just the regular guys in the village that were there, and I would play the song and you song, and afterwards at the bar, they kind of say, hey, because they know I'm a priest. Everyone knows that I'm a priest. So I play the song, and they come from the bar and say, Malcolm, yes, interesting something. Like, that thing about I'm the goodness in the bread, I'm the wildness in the wine, is that like a communion thing? I thought you should say that. Yeah, we have this really good conversation. And, I think I like, if you cut me down, I'll leap back up again, spring back green again, funny enough, let's talk about it. So I'm having these kind of conversations. Meanwhile, we're at Gibbs Hall, the Evangelical College where I'm playing,
And I'm going around pubs singing this song called The Green Man. And, you know, they think, oh God, this guy's a story of your native, you know. And it's kind of, you know, a little group gets together to interview, you know. Without having heard the song or anything, you know. Anyway, so I it was the cause of some controversy. So, see if I can decide, you know, whether you think it's controversial or not. Of course, you can go on the web and there's loads of people, you know, there's lots of kind of green man things and people saying, oh, you know, it's all kind of new age religion. I mean, it may be taken up in that way. But actually, what's being celebrated, you know, this is the one who says that as a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it bears no fruit, but if it bursts, it yields a rich harvest. God made a world in which there would be the death of the seed and the resurrection of the seed, so that we would know what the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is, you know. And so even the first feelings after and findings that there's a divinity in all of that serve Christ in the end. Mark, anyway, you can do so. There's a chorus, by the way, so you could join in there if you wanted to. It's very simple. We have some. I'm the green man, don't take my name in vain. I'm the green man, it's time to break my chain. If you cut me down, I'll spring back green again. My face in the foliage, you've seen that face before. Carved in the choir by the fathers in days of yore. My power in the past, I'm the song underneath the soil. I'm the unseen king of the ditches, rocket and roar.
Your hands, your cup, hugs over my feet.